I'd like to welcome everybody for our second oral argument of this afternoon. Before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that we have here today. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand all the counsel have checked in, so without any further ado, I'll ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Stephen Davis. I am here representing the appellants, Rex Performance Products. We are here on an appeal of the trial court's order to dismiss the case for want of prosecution and subsequent denial of a motion to reinstate. I'm aware that two of your honorable justices are probably fairly familiar with the standard, having ruled on a similar case in 2023. To start, obviously, the court has to review the trial court's determination under an abuse of discretion, meaning they have to have failed, the trial court has to have failed to follow the guiding principles in making their determination, and I would argue today, Your Honors, that the trial court clearly did. This is a complex case. It has spanned multiple years and now multiple courtrooms. And because of that, I think that the court must view the totality of the circumstances, including the fact that prosecution or litigation was taking place in multiple courtrooms in the building down the street. And as part of that, this court has opined that when determining whether or not a dismissal for want of prosecution or a motion to reinstate was entered correctly, the Second Court of Appeals has opined that you must look at the unique circumstances of each case. And I would argue to the court that this case is certainly unique. The case was begun in 2018. It is a complicated matter with breaches of fiduciary duty allegations against the appellees, who were officers of the corporation of the company, Rex Performance Products, related to the sale of assets. Litigation began in 2018 with temporary restraining orders and temporary injunctions. It then progressed to litigation in three states, which with multiple parties. There was a lawsuit in Delaware. There's a lawsuit in Michigan. There's a lawsuit in Texas. The Delaware litigation has been settled. It was between an entity called Pregis Performance Products and Rex, who was originally a party to this case, but was dismissed via special appearance that was appealed. And this court ultimately upheld the granting of the special appearance. The litigation in Michigan has been abated pending the outcome of this case. Litigation was furious. 10 depositions across five states, mountains of discovery. The case was prosecuted diligently to get it prepared for trial. At that point, the 101st District Court granted a summary judgment in favor of the appellees on an affirmative defense of waiver and ratification. That was then taken up to this court. This court overturned the order granting the summary judgment. That was then appealed to the Supreme Court, who declined to hear the case. That gets us to October of 2022 or 2021, which is when the Court of Appeals issued its mandate after all appellate remedies had been exhausted. At that point, the case was ready for trial.
Okay, then I've got a question then. Why didn't you set it for trial? That would not have been a waiver of the special appearance. Why not set it for trial at that point?
I was concerned about two things, Your Honor. The final judgment review rule and race judicata. When the appellees filed their separate lawsuit that was assigned to Judge Cosby in the 67th District Court, as you can see from the record, I believe it's in the first court reporter's record at page 336, correspondence was sent from the appellees advising us that a new lawsuit had been filed and assigned to the 67th District Court. And in that letter, the appellees admit this should have been a counterclaim in the 101st District, in the 141st District Court, but the case was still administratively closed. I couldn't get into it, so I filed it separately. The reason, so then we filed, Rex Hansen is a third party, was added to the 67th District Court case in his individual capacity. Rex Hansen has no contacts to the state of Texas other than in his representative capacity as a corporate representative of Rex Performance Products. So a special appearance was filed pursuant to Rule 120A. To answer your question, Your Honor, because of the final judgment rule, both of these cases, the case in the 141st and the case in the 67th, involve the same people, the same documents, the same general arguments, the same witnesses. They are the same case. But if Rule 120 is strict, we could set the 141st case for trial, the case that we're here under appeal now. But if that case goes to final adjudication, while the case pending in the 67th District Court is still unresolved, we went into claim preclusion, res judicata, and conflict with the final judgment rule. There cannot be two judgments over the same dispute. So if the special appearance was denied, the case would then have to be consolidated with the 141st District Court case, the case that we're here about today. And you can see from the records, Your Honor, we were diligent in prosecuting the litigation in the 67th case. The reason the special appearance did not get set sooner is because the appellees continually asked for continuances of the hearing. We set the hearing four times. There was conflicts. People were out on vacation. My opponent was having shoulder surgery. I did what I think the bar expects attorneys to do, and that's be a good colleague and reschedule hearings. I think that's what the bar asked us to do when somebody has conflicts. I could have said, nah, I don't care about your vacation. You don't have a vacation letter on file. I'm moving forward with my hearing. I don't think that's what we're supposed to do to each other, number one. And number two, had I done that, they would have filed a motion for continuance, and the judge would have understandably granted it, and we'd be in the same place we were. So I can either be a stickler and press it and waste the court's time and cost the clients money, or I can be a good colleague and extend the deadline. And then when my opponent was having shoulder surgery and he didn't know how long it was going to take for him to recover, I'm going to be sympathetic to that. I'm going to wait until he's ready. And you shouldn't be able to take that and then use it as justification to say that the other case hasn't been prosecuted. These cases cannot be taken in a vacuum. The 141st case that's on appeal here cannot be taken in a vacuum without taking in the totality of the circumstances of what is going on in the 67th case. Because if the case had been opened, if the appellees had filed their counterclaim in the 141st case, there would be no question of diligence. There would be nothing to say, well, this case has sat idly by, because it wasn't. It was litigated. And unfortunately, because of the strictness of 128, you're kind of stuck. I can't agree to consolidate it because that may waive my special appearance. I can't engage in litigation until I get the special appearance resolved. I think the case law is pretty clear. Other than defending discovery directed to the special appearance, Rex Hansen can do nothing. The court is, I think it's fair to say, mixed on what standard of review the court is supposed to use to apply to these circumstances. Is it the good cause analysis, or is it the Craddock standard? Is it conscious indifference or reasonable explanation? The Supreme Court has not opined on that question either, except in a dissenting opinion of a denial of a petition of review, which is not necessarily controlling of anything. But regardless of which standard is applied, good cause or Craddock, with conscious indifference, mistake, or reasonable explanation, there is a reasonable explanation for why we are in the position we're in today. And that is, the lawsuit was continuing to be litigated. It was just being litigated in the 67th District Court. because that's where the appellees chose to file their lawsuit, because they could not file it as a counterclaim, and they have admitted that. The delay was caused by request from the appellees to continue special appearance hearings, which we granted as a professional courtesy. So you can't look at just this case, and setting this case for trial doesn't solve the global problem of everything has to be resolved at once. Otherwise, you run into procedural hurdles on whether or not something's final or not. The other thing that I would say, Your Honors, is that it's also a little intriguing from a procedural standpoint. I'm not sure that it makes a difference one way or the other, but I think it's also relevant to note that the trial court didn't set this for dismissal. The trial court didn't issue a notice. The defendants moved for dismissal, which is basically a summary proceeding. Now, certainly the judge has the inherent power to determine his docket regardless of how it gets presented to him. But it's not like the court issued a dismissal notice that it says, set this for trial or I'm throwing it out. The defendants moved for this. And I think that's persuasive. The court wasn't driving this to get it dismissed. The defendants were. After also being the ones to request the extensions of the special appearance hearing in the 67th District Court. The record is clear. Everybody knew that depending on what happened with the special appearance, whether it's granted or denied, if it was denied, the case in the 67th District Court needed to be consolidated with the case in the 141st. And if you look at the totality of the circumstances, the plaintiff was diligent. The plaintiff was prosecuting this case. It was just prosecuting it under a different cause number. And if it had been in the 141st District Court, we wouldn't even be here, because there would have been no grounds to say that this case sat idle for 19 months. So regardless of whether you use the good cause analysis or the Craddock analysis, I think the appellant has met its burden of showing that they were not being consciously indifferent about this case. It was being litigated, and they should not be denied their day in court simply because of the way everything fell out and the fact that the case got assigned to a different judge instead of being assigned to the 141st. And with that, Your Honor, I'll yield the rest of my time.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Kirkman?
May it please the court. After this court rendered its opinion in this case earlier in December of 2020, which of course Judge Womack wrote, a mandate was eventually issued after a failed appeals to the Supreme Court on October 22nd of 2021. This case was back here in the trial court for Judge Chupp, ready to go. There was absolutely no action taken between that day and the day we filed our motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution on June 14th of 2023.
Do you disagree that, I mean, is it true that you were agreeing to these extensions and that you had shoulder surgery?
Judge Walker, that was in another case. Yes, I had shoulder surgery. Yes, I asked for an extension. But that case, as I will demonstrate to you in this argument, is not the same case as this. It's different facts. Res judicata does not apply. Collateral estoppel does not apply. I appreciate the courtesies, but that case is a different case. It involves a different party. It is not this case. And in fact, Judge, I've noticed three times within the briefing in this case, my opponent has said, this is the same case on pages 1, pages 7, and pages 5. He has referenced that this case is the same case as the 67th and said that I said it was, and that's just not true.
But is it not interrelated at all in your mind?
It's interrelated only because it arises out of the same nucleus of original facts because it was a sale of an asset. The suit that Judge Womack wrote her opinion on and involved in this case is an alleged breach of fiduciary duty over a bonus retention that was promised to my clients. The other suit has to do with completely separate facts, monies that were owed that were promised separate and distinct from that. And what I said in my letter, Judge Walker, is I tried to get this case, I'll entertain a motion for consolidation if you're serious about pursuing this case. And that points the difference between the two cases. So I really think that this attempt to blame the 67th and my refusal to agree to an early special appearance in that case is a red herring.
If the special appearance had been denied, do you agree it would be consolidated?
No, I don't. It was Judge Chupp's decision. There's not a res judicata analysis. There's not a collateral estoppel analysis. There's not a compulsory counterclaim. The rules require the same basic nucleus of facts need to exist, and they don't. He might have. He might have consolidated for purposes of convenience, but I can guarantee you it's two separate factual resolutions. So I don't know. In fact, one of the things that the plaintiff could have done, among many things in this case, is file a motion for consolidation. Nothing prevented that. Let this Judge Chupp know you intend to prosecute this case.
Well, now, there's an argument that you'd lose your special appearance.
No, the 120A allows you specifically to take all actions as long as there's not a ruling. 120A is set up so that you can file contemporaneous actions, contemporaneous pleadings, contemporaneous requests, as long as you preserve your right for a special appearance. And I also will remind the court that the person who was the subject of the special appearance was Rex Hansen individually. He was not a party to this case. He was not. This was a dispute between RPP and my clients over this retention bonus, which is evident from a reading of Judge Womack's opinion. When you read the petition in the other case, those bonus retention payments had nothing to do with the acts in that case. Now, they did arise out of the same asset sale. There's no question about that. They were not compulsory counterclaims. Res judicata could not have applied because they were a completely separate set of facts, nor could collateral estoppel have applied. If somebody wanted to consolidate this case and Judge Chupp said, no, I don't find there's compulsory counterclaims, they're not the same set of facts, there is no way that could ever withstand an appeal because it would have been abuse of discretion.
But while this case was on appeal, didn't the 67th transfer the case to the 141st? And I think the order, we can see this because the special appearance from Hansen is on appeal now. So we have that record. And doesn't it also show that the clerk's record shows that the second lawsuit now bears the cause number of the first lawsuit? So haven't they, in essence, been consolidated?
Well, only because the 67th Judge Cosby transferred it here. That he transferred it to the 141st, and then that now ends up before Judge Chupp. But they're two separate proceedings.
But didn't the order say that he changed the number to the first lawsuit?
He did. But that doesn't mean they're necessarily consolidated for purposes of trial, Judge. I don't know what's going to happen in this case. And the point I'm trying to make is Judge Cosby transferred it over here because it appeared to involve the same parties and persons. I get that. This is the oldest case. But there's no order or process or procedure that compels Judge Chupp to try these together. He may. That's his decision. But it doesn't explain the lack of activity in this case, and I respectfully submit to the court that in order to get focused on what happened, that's what needs to be examined. The 19 months of inactivity gave Judge Chupp the absolute discretion to dismiss this case for want of prosecution. There's just no question that if you apply the four factors that that's appropriate. Now, I know this court knows the standards for dismissal of warrant prosecution. I've read opinion after opinion after opinion. I've read the Brown opinion. I've read the Campbell opinion. I've read the AKC opinion, which one or more of you have served on the panel in every one of those. So I know you know the standards. So what we sought is a dismissal for want of prosecution based on two grounds. Number one, they didn't comply with the 18-month rules in the judicial administrative rules. That's number one. And number two, Judge Chupp had the inherent authority to dismiss it for lack of prosecution. Those were the two grounds that we alleged in our motion. And he reviewed that. He had a hearing. To say that he buried his head in the sand, as appellants argue, is just not accurate. There were two separate hearings. So he heard it. He heard it. He granted the motion to dismiss. They then filed a motion to reinstate. We had another hearing, and then he denied the motion to reinstate. So when you decide, well, I've got to make a decision about whether the judge abused his discretion when he dismissed the case for one prosecution, this court knows that there are four factors that have to be analyzed. And this court would have to determine that there was an abuse of discretion in granting that motion. So what are the four factors? What's the length of time this case had been on file? Well, the length of time the case had been on file is 30 months. It had been on file 19 months since the mandate, with absolutely no action taken. And I respectfully suggest that that action was not taken because of me and because they couldn't get a special appearance for a person who is not even a party to this case. It's because they didn't prosecute it. What's the second factor? What is the extent of the activity that was performed in the case since the mandate? Zero. Two vacation letters. It is not reasonable to assume that they couldn't have done something, filed a motion to abate this case, filed a motion to consolidate it, get a scheduling order issued, request a trial setting, do something to let the other side and the court know that they intend to prosecute the case. That extent of activity was zero. Was there a setting request? Not until I filed a motion to dismiss did they ever request a trial setting. None. And then the last factor that the court has to consider is, what is the reasonable excuse for not proceeding forward? And the only thing that they say is that because there was a delay in getting a hearing on a special appearance in the 67th court for a party who was not a party to this suit, that I caused for delay, that's the reasonable basis for not prosecuting the case. I respectfully submit that is insufficient as a matter of law to say, well, there's something going on in the 67th, the other side didn't get a special appearance set for a non-party. Well, I've suggested to you the things that he could have done in this case to prosecute it, and he didn't. How is Judge Chupp to know? I mean, what Judge Chupp says, well, you're trying to get a special appearance set in the 67th for a non-party. What does that have to do with the prosecution of this case involving the bonus retentions? No explanation was given. So think about what is really involved in the mandate and the facts in this case, and I suggest you can't come to any other conclusion. But there was just no absolute legitimate excuse provided to the trial court as to why they hadn't proceeded forward with the case. Now, one of the cases they cited is Property versus State, where they suggest, well, in this criminal case, they gives us authority for wait until the special appearance was granted. Well, that was a forfeiture of property case where a conviction was a condition to getting the property forfeiture issue resolved. So that really doesn't have any factual basis in this particular case. Now, the last issue that I want to explore with you is this dispute, this apparent uncertainty that exists between what is the standard to apply when looking at the trial court's inherent authority to dismiss something for want of prosecution. Because in the briefing, there's clearly a distinction between the standards to apply. Number one is, do you apply conscious indifference? Or number two, do you apply good cause? And I respectfully suggest that this court has already written in Fire Exchange, in Brown versus Sanders, in Campbell versus Heisenman, and in the KT case, that the 165A3 standard, which uses the word conscious indifference, applies to A1 only and not to A2 or not to the court's inherent power to dismiss. because as this court has stated, the following language from Rule 165A3, quote, the court shall reinstate the case upon a finding after hearing that the failure of the party, that refers to the failure of a party to attend a hearing, and a conscious indifference standard ought to apply to that, but a good cause requirement ought to apply to the failure to prosecute a case within the time requirements or the inherent power of the court.
Do you know off the top of your head, and I apologize because I didn't really think about it until now, but all of these cases that you're referencing, do you know how many of those cases pertain to a DWAP docket and how many didn't? I mean, appellant brings up the fact that he thinks it's somewhat unique in that you were the one seeking the dismissal. This wasn't the court's sua sponte action. Do you know that? Do you know the answer to that?
Yes. One of these cases involved the DWAP case. The others didn't. But let me make this suggestion to the court. You know that the standard for dismissal of a case for a default judgment is the Craddock standard of conscious indifference. It makes perfect sense in the context of failure to appear at a particular hearing, which is what A1 addresses, that you have a separate ability to file a motion to reinstate and then present the court with a conscious indifference standard. For instance, let's assume that your case gets dismissed for want of prosecution, but you didn't get the notice. You were in the hospital or you had a family member sick, and you get this notice and you go, whoa, I need to do something. So you file a motion to reinstate, and the standard to be applied in that case where you miss a hearing, which is A1, would be conscious indifference. Put on evidence that you were sick or you had a family member sick or something. That is perfectly reasonable. But that fact-specific conduct really has nothing to do with the court's inherent power to dismiss a case for prosecution or the failure to prosecute a case within 18 months. They're just completely different sets of circumstances. And I suggest to you that the reasonable interpretation of that is that in cases where somebody doesn't prosecute a case diligently and the court dismisses it for its inherent authority to do so, or if the court says you didn't prosecute it timely because you didn't comply with the 18-month requirement, they ought to apply the good cause standard, which this court, in those opinions that I've referenced, has said. But in situations where there's a failure to appear, conscious indifference is an appropriate standard to apply. But I also want to make one last point. In this case, it really shouldn't matter to this court which standard applies to this dismissal for want of prosecution, either under A2 for the lack of timely prosecution in 18 months or the inherent power, because of this. The courts have said that if someone simply repeats in its motion to reinstate the very same arguments that it used in its motion to dismiss, it does not require the court to reread those reasons it gave or the reason it decided to dismiss the case. It has the full discretion and authority to deny the reinstatement when there's no new grounds. And that's what happened in this case. There were no new reasons asserted by the appellant in its motion to reinstate that were set forth in the motion to dismiss. So under clear authority, the court doesn't have to reread those reasons or revisit its opinion when there's nothing else resolved. I'll also tell you that the case law is that you can find there is no abuse of discretion even if a court doesn't hold a hearing on the motion to reinstate. And that's the law. So I suggest to you that because of those cases and those clear points of law in the case law, it really doesn't matter in this case whether you apply a conscious indifference standard or a good cause standard to the motion that was filed. Even though I believe that a reasonable interpretation of 165A is exactly as this court has held previously, that it's a good cause standard that should be applied to the facts and circumstances associated with this case and the motion we filed. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
The counterclaims, or the claims filed in the 67th court, are 100% compulsory counterclaims. They involve the same transaction. They involve the same documents. It's just a different picture of the same contract about compensation. Were they entitled to accounts receivable? Were the appellees required? Versus their breach of that agreement and their breach of their fiduciary duties. So the idea that they are not the same case is simply, I would argue, not accurate. The duplication of the issues were those cases to be tried separately would be insane. I mean, I would posit to the court that it would be necessary for all of the discovery that has taken place in the 141st District Court to be used in the lawsuit against the 67th. Mr. Tate was deposed twice. Mr. Hansen, I believe, was deposed twice in the 141st. They talked about all these issues. So the idea that they're separate is just, I would posit to the court, not accurate. These would absolutely need to be tried together, not only because of the nexus of the agreement, but also because of offsets. Everybody's going to throw offsets at everybody. These cases would have to be tried together. And there's one other thing that has come up a couple of times that I feel compelled to address, which is at no time are the appellants blaming the 67th District Court for anything that has happened in this case. That's been brought up a couple of times. These hearings were taken down before the judge even heard them because it was going to be a waste of judicial resources to make him rule on them. So this idea that, and anybody is saying this is Judge Cosby's fault, is simply not correct. And I think the trial court in the 141st did abuse their discretion, because if you look at the transcript for the motion to dismiss, when the issue of the 67th District Court was raised, the trial judge said, I do not care about what is happening in the 67th District Court. And under the absolute case law, the totality of the circumstances in these situations must be addressed, which means you don't get to not look at what's happening in the 67th District Court. And you can't make arguments such as you should have waived the special appearance and just continued on with the case. A special appearance that, after being transferred, the 141st District Court granted. So it was a meritorious special appearance. And I'll close with this. I try to, when we have first-year law clerks and first-year law students, I have a little mantra that I try to tell them. You argue in the courtroom, you don't argue in the hallway. There's no, like, we all have to get along with each other. All three of you litigated. You've been down in the trenches. It's stressful enough without having antagonism with your opponent and overly agitating opposing counsel. That's not what we're here for. And I don't think that's what the bar expects us to do. So when a colleague asks me for an extension, I give it to him, because I think that's what the court expects us to do. To then have that, extend that grace, when you don't have to, you can be a jerk if you want to be. Lots of people do. I work in Dallas. It's an endemic over there. And then have it turned and used against you as justification for getting the other case dismissed, regardless of the standards. It's not right. And I don't think that's how 165 is meant to be interpreted. And I don't think my client should lose his day in court because I extended courtesies that I would expect other lawyers to extend to me if I had the same circumstances. We're supposed to work with each other. And I don't think it's proper that the case got that the 141st case got dismissed because it took us a year to get a special appearance heard in the 67th. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the oral argument, gentlemen. It's been very helpful, and your case is submitted. We will stand in recess.